Research into long COVID, which is also known as post-acute sequelae of COVID-19 and is usually defined as COVID-19 symptoms that last longer than 3 months, has lagged behind the studies of the acute phase of infection. People who experience long COVID live with a wide array of symptoms, ranging from mild to severely debilitating. Researchers have propose a variety of causes for the condition, from lingering viral reservoir to autoimmunity to tiny blood clots. Many think that a mix of these factors is to blame. It could take a while to get going on any serious mechanistic long COVID research, says immunologist Danny Altman at Imperial College London, adding it's hard to piece the big picture together. Thus far, vaccines are the best way to prevent long COVID. COVID-19 vaccines reduce the risk of SARS-CoV infection, and they might lessen the risk of long COVID after a breakthrough infection in someone who has been vaccinated. Several studies have looked at this question. Although they have yielded divergent results, the overall trend suggests that vaccination could reduce the risk of long COVID by about half among those who became infected after vaccination. For example, one study that has not yet been peer-reviewed found that vaccination reduced the chances of developing long COVID symptoms by about 41% in more than 3,000 double-vaccinated participants who were later infected with SARS-CoV-2. But that still leaves too many people at risk of getting long COVID, says Altman. Half is not as good as I thought it would be, he says, adding, I was thinking and hoping that long COVID would be a thing of the past. Beyond vaccination, it's unclear whether any existing COVID-19 therapy has an effect on long COVID risk. In theory, a drug that reduces disease severity might reduce the severity of long-term symptoms, says Altman. But long COVID is not always associated with serious acute illness. There are loads of people out there who are really destroyed by long COVID and had symptomatic or near asymptomatic infections, he says, adding, it's really hard to grapple with. Nevertheless, some studies plan to look at the impact of early treatment with antiviral drugs on long COVID. A clinical trial called Panoramic has been testing the effects of oral antiviral molnupiravir, developed by Merck in New Jersey, and Biotherapeutics in Miami, on COVID-19 severity. Although it is not the primary goal of the study, researchers will gather data from participants at 3 and 6 months after treatment, which could determine whether the drug affects long COVID risk. Researchers are hoping to find out whether more treatments can reduce the risk of long COVID. A large UK-based trial called Heal COVID is testing two drugs that target the cardiovascular system in people who have been hospitalized with COVID-19. One called Apixaban is an anticoagulant. The other, Astrovastatin, is a cholesterol-lowering medication thought to reduce inflammation in blood vessels. The study will investigate whether either treatment reduces hospitalizations and deaths in the year after people are first discharged from hospital. Nearly one-third of people who are discharged after treatment for COVID-19 are readmitted within 6 months, and 12% die within 6 months of their initial discharge. And when we looked at what was most plausibly leading to death after hospitalization, it was probably the cardiopulmonary effects, says Summers, who is leading the study. At the University of Chicago in Illinois, pulmonologist and critical care physician Ayeji Adesoy has observed a possible increase in the accumulation of a scar tissue called fibrosis in the lungs well after the acute infection in people who were hospitalized with COVID-19 and required supplemental oxygen. He is now testing a drug called sirolimus, an immune-suppressing drug that is sometimes given to organ transplant recipients in such people in the hope that it will prevent the migration of cells that promote fibrosis in the lung. By their nature, long COVID studies require patience. One commonly accepted definition of long COVID is the persistence of certain symptoms for more than 12 weeks after acute infection. Altman is optimistic that this year will yield advances, but cautions against reading too much into small trials that might not yield the statistically meaningful results. There is such pressure, he says. There is this incredibly pressing and desperate need. We all feel that anxiety.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this programme, we will address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, the people, and also the region as a whole. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Nowruz and how it is celebrated in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Nowruz in India and International Nowruz Day.
The spelling of Nowruz and its pronunciation may vary country to country, but across all nations, it means the new day. It marks the first day of spring and is celebrated as the beginning of the new year by over 300 million people in different parts of the world. Nowruz has been celebrated for over 3,000 years in the Balkans, the Black Sea Basin, the Caucasus, the West, Central and South Asian region, and of course, the subcontinent.
Nowruz, March the 21st of the Gregorian calendar, is the Iranian New Year, also known as the Persian New Year. It begins on the spring equinox on the northern hemisphere. It marks the first day of Farvardin, which is the first month of the Iranian solar calendar. In Iran, one of the most important traditions practiced during this time is that families and loved ones gather around a table called Haftsin. It is decorated with at least seven objects whose names start with an S in the Persian language. The items symbolize purity, brightness, livelihood, and wealth. People wish for prosperity and new beginnings at the New Year time.
What really Nowruz is? Is it a religious holiday or otherwise? Though it is largely a secular celebration, it is often associated with and influenced by, you know, the pre-Islamic religion that was followed in Iran, Zoroastrianism and Parsiism, in which Nowruz is a religious holiday. The festival is celebrated in many countries, with significant Iranian / Persian cultural influence, including Iran, Iraq, India, Afghanistan, and much of Central Asia. So that, if you like, is it's a 3,000-year-old celebration, and as I said, it has roots as far as the festivities concerned in Zoroastrianism, but it has become quite a significant holiday and a period of celebration and families and friends to get together.
Nowruz is preceded by house cleaning, literally translated as shaking the house. People prepare for the new year with a major cleaning of their places and buying new clothes and flowers. It is followed by 4 days of national holidays, but students of all grades and private businesses usually extend the holidays to 2 weeks. It is an opportunity for people to visit parents, relatives, and friends. Gifts are exchanged, especially for children who are thrilled by the presents. There are also street performances of music, public rituals, and the making of handicrafts, which interest the vacationers across the country.
Nowruz has Iranian origins, but it's an international festival now. People in many countries continue following the old traditions, but the traditions slightly change community to community. They include the rituals, prayers, and customs. Iran and Afghanistan have a lot in common, including Nowruz. However, people of Afghanistan celebrate it with minor differences. It's also true about Pakistan, which shares borders with Iran and Afghanistan. Despite minor differences in celebrations, the three nations translate Nowruz as a new beginning and the end of darkness.
Afghans celebrate Nowruz like Iranians, but with small differences. They too celebrate Nowruz usually for 2 weeks, starting from the first day of the new year on March the 21st. They prepare haftmewa, or seven fruits. It is made up of seven kinds of dried fruits served in their own syrup. This is prepared instead of or in addition to haftseen. In Mazar-e-Sharif, the Red Flower Festival starts on Nowruz and includes visiting red tulips in bloom. There are also Jahinda Bala, the raising of a colorful banner outside the Blue Mosque, and a national tournament called Buzkashi. The day following Nowruz is Farmers' Day. It is marked with ceremonies and displays of agricultural products.
Nowruz really promotes, if you like, values of peace and solidarity between generations and within families. In fact, the United Nations says that it's the time of reconciliation and neighborliness, contributing to cultural diversity and friendship among peoples and of different communities. So it has survived three millennia. Therefore, it appears to be a significant occasion on which families, friends, neighbors all get together to celebrate. As you well know, it's on the 21st of March, which is also the equinox, which is, you know, the longest day, if you like, in the it's equal sort of day and night in the Northern Hemisphere.
In Pakistan, Nowruz is celebrated by Shia Muslims, especially in northern areas near the border with Afghanistan. Various communities have historically celebrated Nowruz. Meanwhile, in Lahore, Jashn-e-Baharan, or Spring Festival, is held. It starts in late February or early March each year to mark the spring season. This festival continues until March the 23rd, Pakistan Day. It commemorates the adoption of the first constitution of Pakistan on March the 23rd, 1956. The Spring Festival has been held since ancient times and shares the same spirit with Nowruz.
Nowruz is one of the rare occasions that both India and Pakistan celebrate together. On Nowruz, many Indians hold a New Year festival. Several communities in India, irrespective of their religious background, observe Nowruz. It was brought up in Kashmir too, and the society culturally celebrate Nowruz as a tradition. Now, Nowruz has become an integral part of the culture in many parts of the subcontinent, like a system of values shared by various communities across the region.
India is also a country in which nature's changes are celebrated. In that country, there are people of Iranian origin, especially in Mumbai and Gujarat. They celebrate Nowruz similar to Iranians, with great passion on March the 21st. People clean and decorate their houses and buy new clothes prior to the occasion of Nowruz. They celebrate the day with various delicious traditional foods. People wear new clothes and visit each other. Hosts welcome the guests with greetings that go by hugs and kisses on the head or hands as a gesture of respect. Guests are treated with tasty meals and sweets, and children in the family are rewarded with gifts by elder members.
In the subcontinent, people do celebrate it as a function, albeit it's a secular sort of event rather than being a religious from a purely Islamic point of view. But nonetheless, it will give people in troubled parts of the world some respite for a few days, I suspect, during this period of celebration.
Kashmir in spring displays absolute beauties of nature in the form of high mountains with ice-capped summits, amazing valleys and astonishing flora and fauna. Here too, people celebrate nature's rebirth. The Nowruz celebration marks the new year. Nowruz literally means new day. The Almonds Blossom Festival and Jashna Bahar in Srinagar have become symbols of the onset of spring. They are celebrated by Muslims and non-Muslims together. Hindu, Shaivite and Sufi Islam, as well as Shia and Sunni Brotherhood, all come together to welcome the advent of spring after months of harsh winter.
It's very interesting to know that wherever the Iranian culture went, and even in subcontinent, India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, Nowruz has been celebrated for centuries. Because as you know, the Mughal Empire, and even prior to that, there were a lot of Iranian sort of origin rulers. For example, in Hyderabad, in southern India, there was a Bahmani kingdom, which created the Golconda in southern India. So they obviously brought the culture with them from Iran. And of course, that became quite a significant part of their living interaction with the indigenous sort of population when they arrived in South India, and they carried on with that. So insofar as politics is concerned, I don't know how much impact it has on politics, but obviously culture is part of any political matrix that happens in any part of the world.
Nowruz is an ancient festival that is celebrated all over the world. It's not restricted to any particular region. Nowruz has been turned into a common language of millions of people all around the world. Each year, Nowruz marks a new beginning. It is hope, revival, new life, and diversity. It plays a significant role to strengthen the cultural ties, a soft power uniting the East and the West. This notion has been welcomed by international bodies as well.
International Nowruz Day was proclaimed by the United Nations General Assembly in 2010. 11 member states, namely Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Albania, Macedonia, Iran, India, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkey, and Turkmenistan, drafted the resolution under the agenda item of Culture of Peace. The move by UNESCO to include Nowruz in its representative list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity was welcomed in the UN General Assembly. The UN embraces international days and weeks as a powerful advocacy tool. It educates the public on various issues and mobilizes the world's political will and resources to address concerns. Hence, Nowruz was recognized as an international day. The UN has recognized March the 21st as the International Day of Nowruz. It also encourages member states, international bodies, funds and programs to participate in Nowruz celebrations.
Well, certainly in those parts of the world which have had cultural ties with Iran over the last many centuries do mark this particular event. As I said, South Asia, which is India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, plus the southern Russian republics, even in parts of the Balkans, Bosnia and so on, Nowruz is celebrated, and one sees many YouTube clips from different parts of the world where they celebrate in their own authentic manner, perhaps not the same way as perhaps in Tehran or Tabriz or Shiraz in Isfahan they celebrate, but they have their own local twist to the celebration. But certainly it has become a significant part of the annual calendar in many of the countries bordering Iran and those countries that have Iranian cultural heritage with them.
Nowruz predates the establishment of the United Nations, but it still effectively promotes harmony, empathy, solidarity, interaction, and dialogue of cultures. This day is about integrity and interaction, peace and prosperity, justice and joy, to deal with wars and civilizations and diversity. It emphasizes cultural convergence, brings about kindness and peaceful coexistence. Nowruz makes a platform for further interactions among nations on the one hand and states on the other hand.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now we are joined by Mr. Muzamil Makbul at Rumi Peace Center in Kashmir to talk further about Nowruz. First of all, welcome to the program, talking about the significance of the geographically wide celebration for Nowruz.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here. And Nowruz marks the New Year celebration for millions and millions of people. Around 300 plus million people across the world celebrate this as a New Year, you know, a sort of Persian New Year, especially in the regions like the Balkans, the Caucasus, Central Asia, Middle East, and in Central Asia, you know, after Central Asia, South East Asia as well, you know, especially in India, Pakistan, Iran as well, you know, where it is celebrated with all the, you know, religious fervor. You know, there is festivity all around Iran, you know, on the occasion of Nowruz. The main significance and the basic motto and the center core of attraction in the point is to meet the loved ones, to make sure that, you know, there are prayers held in each you know, community, and a lot of people celebrate Nowruz in their own way, because this also marks the beginning of the spring, the first day of the spring. It has a very, you know, vast significance as well as, you know, culturally attached significance, and which has changed time to time and over the years and over the decades. But the center, as I said, the center core point is for peace, prosperity, and brotherhood across the world, across the universe, and to seen and to unseen, basically for each and everyone.
Mr. Makbul, what makes Nowruz live on throughout millenniums of wars, diseases, famine, and so on?
Nowruz has been celebrated for over 3,000 years, you know, more than 3,000 years. So this huge number comes with a lot of, you know, ethnicity, diversity, identity, and its background, and the cultural changes as well. Now, definitely it has lived through a millennium of wars, epidemics, pandemics, you know, and whatnot. Because this, as I said, the center core message, the message which has been upheld till now around the world, around the globe, is is of peace, prosperity, and as I said, in the different cultures, you know, different people from different faiths celebrate this mark the beginning of the new year, first day of the spring. This naturally sends a vibe of positivity across the world. You know, that is the reason, you know, Nowruz has lived through a lot of difficult times around the world, and if we will count the recent one, COVID-19, you know, which has devastated almost entire globe, but still the culture of celebrating the new year with positivity, with the religious fervor, having your loved ones with you, should continue to go on.
Obviously, Mr. Makbul, Nowruz affects the nations, but how does it affect the states?
Well, as I said, you know, it has a different, it has a vast cultural background, so different people, you know, celebrate it in their own unique way. But if we will talk about, you know, India, Pakistan, and if we'll talk about, especially about Iran, you know, it's celebrated by meeting your loved ones, by you know, spending a couple of days, you know, with all the loved ones, including parents, upholding the prayers, community meetings, and discussing the way forward for the entire year. It has a vast positive impact on the cultures, you know, which define who actually you are. And at the same time, you know, there is no harm in it, you know, when the message is all about peace, when the message is all about positivity, when there is a time when prayers are held to have a global peace for each and everyone, basically, you know, as I said, you know, it doesn't get confined to Islam only. So that's how it promotes a culture of oneness. That is very, very important, you know. There is no. We live in times when world is divided into through colors. When world is divided through the GDP of each and every country. When world is divided through the religion. But Nowruz is a time, you know, when it sends out a positive message that, you know, there is, we should recognize the entire humanity race as one. And definitely it has impact on culture, the country we live in, the state or the region we live in, and it has positive impact on the political structures of that country as well.
Mr. Makbul, how do Afghans celebrate Nowruz when they are already on the brink of a humanitarian disaster?
Well, that's actually a very important question. You know, Afghanistan is a region which has not been conquered by anyone. A lot of monarchs, kings, as well as the governments tried to rule, but no one could rule it till now, except the Afghanis, the local Afghanis, you know, who really want to know what they can do for their own country. But at the same time, the occasion of Nowruz is something, you know, which sends, which will give them also an opportunity to recover, restart, and rebuild. You know, that's the main occasion. And especially, you know, we have seen a lot of scenarios, you know, which have been changed from the recent past few months. So that also gives a vast opportunity for Afghan people who have been devastated by the war, not from recent years, but from decades and decades. You know, they have seen basically ABC and XYZ, basically everything of what war is actually. But this Nowruz would be an occasion especially focused on children, and I want to use your platform to appeal the United Nations International Children Emergency Fund to enhance their projects in the regions where they are not going into Afghanistan right now. This is the right time and the right platform for United Nations Alliance of Civilizations, you know, to recover, restart, and rebuild, you know, projects related to education, especially focusing on the mental health of women and children. So that would be a great, great surprise for the nation of Afghanistan on the eve of Nowruz.
Last but not least, Mr. Makbul, how do you view Nowruz transnationally?
Well, again, that's a very important question, you know. For unity, Nowruz is typically celebrated in Gilgit, Balochistan, Baltistan, Swat, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and the other regions, you know, other tribal regions in Pakistan, which borders with the Afghanistan as well. And time and again, there have been small, disturbances, a sort of, you know, border conflict, we can say, a sort of border conflict in between these tribal regions and Afghanistan, Afghanis as well. So I think it would be an opportunity for both the regions as well as the tribes tribals of the entire regions, you know, which borders with the Pakistan and as well as with the Iran as well, you know, to come together and jointly take a message forward on how to restart and rebuild the entire Afghanistan and what could be the possible way out for peace, for education, very importantly, and for the, you know, stability and empowerment of women. That is how, you know, a nation, a region, an entire region would grow. And as I said, you know, this occasion would be a perfect example for all the aid organizations, especially, you know, the wings of United Nations, who can you know, reach out and move beyond capital of Afghanistan and go to these, you know, border areas, these regions, and start their projects related to education, emergency aid, healthcare, as well as, you know, mental health and mental health, especially the life skills and mental health of, you know, children as well. So that would be a great opportunity, you know, for the children, and it would make and prosper the future of Afghanistan and the entire region as well.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Makbul for his precious time, knowledge, and insight.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And that was our episode covering Nowruz, its history, and how we celebrate it in the South Asian region. Thank you and a happy Nowruz.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Rich countries must end all oil and gas production in the next 12 years, while the poorest nations should be given 28 years to provide a fair transition away from fossil fuels, according to a new study. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Matthew Taylor. The piece is titled, Rich Countries Must Stop Producing Oil and Gas by 2034, says study. Rich countries must end all oil and gas production in the next 12 years, while the poorest nations should be given 28 years to provide a fair transition away from fossil fuels, according to a new study by researchers in Britain. The report, led by Professor Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at Manchester University in northwest England, found that wealthy countries such as the United Kingdom, United States and Australia had until 2034 to stop all oil and gas production to give the world a 50% chance of preventing devastating climate breakdown, while the poorest nations that are also heavily reliant on fossil fuels should be given until 2050. Professor Kevin Anderson said that while it was now clear there had to be a rapid shift away from a fossil fuel economy, it was essential this was done in a fair and equitable way. There are huge differences in the ability of countries to end oil and gas production while maintaining vibrant economies and delivering a just transition for their citizens, he said. The report examines each country's wealth and how dependent its economy is on fossil fuel production. It found that many poorer nations would be crippled economically and politically by a rapid move away from oil and gas, while wealthier nations could afford to end fossil fuel production while remaining relatively prosperous. For example, the study found that oil and gas revenue contributed 8% to America's gross domestic product, or GDP, but without it, the country's GDP per head would still be around $60,000, the second highest globally. Meanwhile, countries such as South Sudan, the Republic of Congo and Gabon, despite being small producers of oil and gas, have little other economic revenue and would be devastated by a rapid transformation away from fossil fuels. Cristiana Figueres, the former United Nations climate chief who oversaw the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, welcomed the findings of the new report. Cristiana Figueres emphasized, "This new study is a timely reminder that all countries must phase out oil and gas production rapidly, with wealthy countries going fastest, while also ensuring a just transition for workers and communities that rely on it." The report's findings come amid a renewed focus on climate justice among civil society groups in countries in the global south, particularly at last year's COP26 conference in Glasgow, Scotland. But Professor Kevin Anderson warned many wealthier nations still only paid lip service to the idea. Professor Anderson said, "I don't see any sense of equity being taken seriously by the policymakers in the wealthy parts of the world." The study, commissioned by the International Institute for Sustainable Development, quantifies how much future oil and gas production is consistent with the Paris Climate Accord and the Paris target of 1.5 degrees Celsius of heating, and what this means for the 88 countries responsible for 99.97% of global oil and gas supply. It found that for a 50% chance of limiting the global temperature rise to just 1.5 degrees Celsius, the 19 highest capacity countries with average non-oil gross domestic product per capita of more than $50,000 must end production by 2034, with a 74% cut by 2030. This group produces 35% of global oil and gas and includes the United States, Britain, Norway, Canada, Australia, and the United Arab Emirates. The 14 high-capacity countries with average non-oil gross domestic product per capita of nearly $28,000 must end production by 2039, with a 43% cut by 2030. They produce 30% of global oil and gas and include countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Kazakhstan. 11 medium-capacity countries with average non-oil gross domestic product per capita of $17,000 must end production by 2043, with a 28% cut by 2030. This group produces 11% of global oil and gas and includes countries like China, Brazil, and Mexico. 19 low-capacity countries with average non-oil gross domestic product per capita of $10,000 must end production by 2045, with an 18% cut by 2030. This group produces 13% of global oil and gas and includes countries like Indonesia and Egypt. 25 lowest-capacity countries with average non-oil gross domestic product per capita of $3,600 must end production by 2050, with a 14% cut by 2030. This group produces 11% of global oil and gas and includes countries like Iraq, Libya, Angola, and South Sudan. The study found that even this time scale, poorer countries would need financial support to make the transition if they were to avoid massive economic and political upheaval. Liddy Nakpil, a climate justice campaigner and coordinator of the Asian People's Movement on Debt and Development, said, "A rapid, just and equitable phase-out of oil and gas is still possible, with a time frame suggested in this report as long as rich countries provide substantial financial, technical and political support and cancel the debt."
Economic Divide.
The world energy markets, as a result of the war in Ukraine, have been thrown into a mayhem. The U.S. and the Europeans are pressuring Russia, albeit in different degrees. But have we entered a new world energy order due to the Ukraine conflict post-Putin? Hi, I'm Kavitar Voyer, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how the world energy landscape has changed, maybe for good. Coming up in this program, the U.S. has barred Russian oil imports, looking for alternatives. Meanwhile, Europe has diverged from the U.S., announcing that by mid-May, we will come up with a proposal to get off Russian oil, gas, and coal by 2027. Was there a divergence there? Next up, the U.S. left in a cold. Well, Russia's partnership with the top oil producers like Saudi Arabia, jointly leading the OPEC coalition, has so far stayed intact, but the U.S. pressure has not worked. Does that mean that the U.S. is left out in the cold as a result? And then finally, the new world energy order emerging after Putin. Is this what we are looking at as a result of the Ukraine conflict? Are fresh alliances and blocs aligning with each other from West Asia to Russia itself and beyond? Is an Eastern pivot taking shape?
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has already disrupted energy and financial markets, pushing industrialized nations in Europe and North America to stabilize rising oil prices. Amid threats of an oil embargo, Russia says that it could potentially sell that oil elsewhere, perhaps to China or India. Analysts believe energy imports from Russia will not be quickly replaced. Even if countries release their strategic petroleum reserves and the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, pumps more oil, prices are likely to stay high.
There is no capacity in the world at the moment that can replace 7 million barrels of exports, assuming that we are going to lose a volume of that region. Some are even, my colleagues are even talking of maybe 8 million when you put crude products, other liquids. The world simply does not have the capacity. So it's not about market share now. It's how do we mitigate? How do we overcome this crisis?
Amid the chaos, the U.S. president has reached out to its allies in the Persian Gulf region to ramp up production to tame the prices. But the reports indicate that the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have declined calls. However, the UAE's ambassador to Washington has said the country wants to increase oil production and will encourage the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, to ramp up supply. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait could potentially ramp up production by 2.1 million barrels per day from current levels within a couple of months. Last week, OPEC Plus, which includes Russia, declined to increase oil production despite Western treaties. Reports of frigid communications with Saudi Arabia come as the Biden administration seeks to increase oil supply after formally banning Russian oil imports.
The Ukraine conflict has definitely caused a major shift in how to replace Russian energy supplies, like oil and even commodities like wheat. But if the world, or should I say the U.S., and to some degree Europe, is moving on this track, won't that spell a new world energy order? Let's see what people had to say about this online. This is what the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, had to say about migration and actually food production. Biden's climate czar John Kerry on migration said, wait until you see 100 million people for whom the entire food production capacity has collapsed. Now, this entry actually points to an incentive behind the U.S. and Europe in keeping this war going, although it can't be really proven, but it could be a likely scenario. I can't tweet this enough. Nathaniel Rothschild is desperate to keep the snake's head and is requesting governments up their game to defeat in order to save the world. This war is between Europe and the EU against Russia. Now, as energy markets are rattled by the interruption in the available supplies, this entry may nail it on the head. A new world energy order is emerging from Putin's war in Ukraine. This entry quoted what is said to be something that is going on regarding the world energy crisis. And, of course, it represents a redrawing of the energy and geopolitical map in Europe. Taking a look, finally, at this particular post, we have been telling you on this program about the following, and the Ukraine conflict may prove our point. This particular viewer agrees with us. He goes on to say, what is unfolding right now is only starting and will change the world order for good. Russia, China will be an integrated new power bloc that has ample natural resources, ample labor force, growing energy consumption per capita, ample ability to produce goods and services. Okay, some of the viewer posts there. Well, let's now bring in a guest for this section of the Q&A. We have brought in Pai Ian, who's an independent political and economic researcher from Los Angeles, who joins us here. Pai Ian, welcome to the program. Looking at what is happening with oil, $200 a barrel is what we're looking at as possibilities for the oil prices to hit. Now, the U.S. president has tried to contact Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but they're not even returning their calls, his calls. And at the same time, the UAE has said OPEC needs to decide on whether it's going to ramp up production. What are your thoughts when it comes to the energy crisis that's happening here?
I mean, this is all further geopolitical and geoeconomic theater. Basically, no one in Saudi Arabia runs Saudi Arabia, and the same goes for the UAE, for that matter. They're both satellite states run from the city of London, which remains the financial capital of the world. It's theater also because oil, quote-unquote, prices are therefore set from the city of London, just as the gold price is, and for monetarily related reasons. Energy prices cannot be relegated to the whims of OPEC, which reports to London, New York, and Swiss banks, let alone to any credible notion of a quote-unquote free market dictated by supposed supply and demand. Oil prices are thus hiked tactically by the banks in charge of petrodollar reserve recycling in order to cushion their capital coffers just before major asset consolidation waves.
Okay, by Ian there. We, at this point, will bring in Koichiro Tanaka, who's a professor at Keio University. He joins us from Tokyo. Koichiro Tanaka, welcome. It's really strange how the U.S. is called energy dependent, but at the same time, it can't even help itself. I mean, taking a look at the U.S. oil industry as it is exists today, it seems like it can't ramp up its oil production beyond just a limited period of time. Tell us why there's then that situation when it comes to U.S. oil capacity in production.
Well, I think it's the difficulty that the United States or any free economy would face. These oil producers or oil companies in the United States are not national or state-owned enterprises. They are totally private. So when they see that the oil prices are low or that they see that a unfavorable condition or circumstances are arising, then they would cut their production or even cut their investment. So it's quite difficult comparing the U.S. system or the U.S. economy with the economy like Russia or China. Now, the shale industry in the United States requires a lot of investment and preparation to expand and maintain or even maintain its output.
Our info news section is upon us, and there were plenty of news from around the world to cover. Well, our first entry takes us to the UK. Energy shortages worldwide. UK is not immune to it, and it's experiencing a very severe one. Now, we've talked about this, but this charity has issued a warning about the cost of living in that country. Rural communities are without access to gas. Therefore, as a consequence, they're facing a tsunami of poverty. And because of that, there are calls on the government to help out, because 14%, that's 14% of UK households, are off-grid without access to main gas. So obviously a big problem for that country. Next up, inflation, the UK conflict to make inflation last longer. Is that going to be the case? It appears that that would be the case. There's a 50-50 chance of that happening. Aside from the energy shortage worldwide as a result of this, you're having things like food shortages also contribute to inflation. That has been going on for quite some time, food costs going up. But wheat, as a result of the shortage that's caused by having these sanctions on Russia, contributes to that. Moving on, Russian loan defaults. Yeah, that's a problem. Russian sanctions are causing creditors to really get worried because they could lose billions in Russian loans. Well, obviously, Russia being such a top producer when it comes to, for example, energy, just as one example, for one particular field, it has obviously opted for loans in the past. And so creditors are the ones that may lose out on that. And that's a big problem because that then also can contribute to inflation, believe it or not. And finally, poverty in the Americas. We figure we go to that part of the world. You have 5 million people who are in extreme poverty and are highly exposed to disasters as a result of that, whether directly or indirectly. So the Americas has a poverty problem. Not that anywhere around the world this poverty isn't there, but it's been persistent. 86 million people actually live in extreme poverty in the Americas. And when we talk about the Americas, we're talking about Latin America and also the Caribbean nations as a result. Those were the topics that we picked. Hopefully it's something that you liked. But in particular, we're looking for what you have to propose to us. That's what we look forward to. So send us any comments or suggestions that you may have. We'll make sure that we cover it in this program.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
You've heard about a new world order, hopefully, but how about a new world energy order? That is something which is now being talked about, which is the subject of our in-depth section. Okay, first let's take a look at the 27-nation bloc that is called the European Union. Now, although the EU is confused about whether it can actually disconnect from Russian energy, it has responded and it has gone ahead and actually speeded up its disconnection from Russian gas. At least they are trying to do that, and that's a big question mark. Now, in the meantime, the U.S. has barred Russian oil imports and is searching for alternative energy supplies. OPEC countries in particular, Saudi Arabia, for example, at this point, aside from Saudi Arabia, the OPEC countries, they're basking in the high oil prices after prices collapsed 2 years ago. And when the U.S. reached out to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, not only did they not take the call, later the UAE said whatever OPEC decides for an increase in production, that is when we'll do it, even though the UAE said that it would on its own perhaps go for production, an increase in production. Well, in order to understand the gravity of the situation, this is how this particular person has actually described this. This represents the biggest redrawing of the energy and geopolitical map in Europe and possibly the world since the collapse of the Soviet Union, if not the end of World War II, obviously in reference to the conflict in Ukraine. He goes on to say, in terms of what the outcome will be, the outcome could be a sequel to the Cold War. Bob McNally is his name. He's the president of Rapidan Energy Group, and he was also a White House official, a former White House official. Now, let's move on to Ian Bremmer. You may have heard of him. He's appeared on many talk shows. President of the Eurasia Group. He believes in the New World Energy Order, and he actually names Germany as an example. Let's take a listen to him.
I think that this is a tipping point. Won't end globalization. But it does end the peace dividend. It does mean that the Europeans overnight will and must prioritize spending on defense, policy on national security, coordination on NATO. The speech that was given by Olaf Scholz, the new chancellor, 2 weeks ago, in my view, the most significant speech given by a European leader in the post-Cold War environment.
Okay, he says, as you heard him there, days after Russia actually sent its forces into Ukraine, he referred to Germany. Well, the chancellor is Olaf Scholz, in which he announced, as Ian Bremmer just said, a massive increase in Germany's defense budget, along with plans to pursue greater energy security. Now, at the center of this rapprochement that happened with the former Soviet Union and then obviously Russia, you have oil and gas links that are centered to political engagements. So this is what Ostpolitik, why are we talking about this? Well, because Germany, to decouple from Russia, is going to be tough, but it's gone ahead. Don't forget, the halt of the $11 billion Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline is just one of the most visible signs. All right, let's bring in some analysis into this. Let me introduce our guest for this section. We have with us Scott Ritter, a former UN Iraq weapons inspector who joins us. Scott Ritter, welcome. Looking at the shifts that are underway, they've been described as inflaming old grievances by one particular analyst, but at the same time, this is an opportunity, this shift in the world order for fresh alliances and blocs that are aligning with each other. What is this new world order that is rising because of the energy shifts, tectonic shifts that's been described?
Here, now, as the West seeks to divorce itself from Russia, the number two energy producer in the world, this isn't just an economic question, but a geopolitical question. This is not just about trying to isolate Russia. This is about Russia trying to isolate the West. This is about Russia saying that we reject the rules-based international order that the United States has shoved down the world's throat since the end of the Second World War. This is about Russia saying we're willing to work with nations like China, India, Pakistan, Iran, South Africa, Brazil, Mexico, and others to create a multipolar world that revolves around the notion of a law-based international order, and that law being the United Nations Charter, something the United States helped draft but has been assiduously ignoring us ever since then. So we're looking at a fundamental realignment of the world away from, you know, the American-centric universe that had existed to a multipolarity. Whether or not this shift will be successful, we don't know. The United States and Europe may still hold enough cards to beat back for the moment.
Okay, great. Let's bring in another analysis into this. We are looking here at having Pai Ian rejoin us. He's the independent political and economic researcher. Pai Ian, welcome back. So the U.S. Going as far into the Americas, reaching out to Venezuela to speak to a government that it doesn't even officially recognize to see if it could maybe have them facilitate oil production and have it inject into the oil production for the world, really. But do you think that that is going to, A, happen, and B, maybe an ulterior motive might be for the U.S. to drive a wedge between Venezuela and Russia to, I guess, break that relationship?
Yes, wedge geopolitics is indeed at work, and yet is nothing new. Consider how Kissinger and Nixon drove a wedge between the Soviet Union and China five decades ago. Atlanticists have been trying to reprise that act for years, but to reverse effects, as Russia and China are practically married now. Hence, trying to patch things up in rushed fashion with Venezuela and Iran partly represents shrewd means of trying to reintegrate those nations as means of energy supply, pricing, and trading back onto a fully petrodollar recycling-based fold between New York and London. That aspect is transparent, however, to both Caracas and Tehran, and they're essentially both on board Eurasian alternatives to the petrodollar for what that's worth.
The current energy crisis has highlighted the importance of other major energy producers, which have been shunned by Western powers. Just last week, U.S. officials met Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in Caracas for the first bilateral talks in years, even though the U.S. does not officially recognize the Maduro government. U.S. officials have demanded Venezuela supply at least a portion of oil exports to the U.S. as part of any agreement to ease oil trading sanctions on OPEC member nations. Venezuela is a Russian ally and has the world's largest oil reserves. U.S. officials made clear their priority was to secure supplies for the United States. Prospects of more oil exports by Venezuela comes amid reports of Iran's comeback to the energy markets. The JCPOA revival talks could bring significant volumes of Iranian oil back to the market. Caracas and Tehran would have been unlikely sources of relief for a U.S.-led Western alliance before Russia's military operation in Ukraine, before sanctions were applied on Iran, produced about 4 million barrels per day.